I love that song. So thank you so much for inviting me. I'm going to tell you a story first that sort of is apropos of what we're talking about today. Last week I got an email from a guy in Vienna, and what he said was, "I am the only Jewish criminal attorney at law in Vienna and a member of the executive board of Austria's oldest main and central synagogue, the famous Vienna Stadttempel. Today we are a small but wealthy and flourishing Jewish community with 21 synagogues, 5 kosher restaurants, 3 Jewish high schools, and 1 small Jewish university. But as the only child of Holocaust survivors, I do not forget our history." And then he went on to say that because my publisher had published my books and I was a member of Jewish Voice for Peace and I supported the boycott of Israel, that I was actually a danger to society. And he went on to say that a boycott is a form of violence. And went on to explain, "Remember, the Holocaust began with the boycott of Jewish shops, Jewish lawyers, Jewish doctors, and Jewish institutions. Boycott of Jews was the beginning of the worst mass murderer in history, the Shoah." And he went on to talk more about that and ended with, "So please tell Dr. Rothschild and her friends not to come to our synagogue. These people are not welcome here. We do not want to see them. We do not want to hear them. We do not want to pray with them. They can stay wherever they want, but please let them stay away from us." So as a Jewish activist, how do I find my beloved community? And what I'm going to reflect on today is what it's been like growing up in the American Jewish community, and then learning about the lives of Palestinians, and becoming aware of the parallel narratives of the two peoples. I'm going to ask, why and how did I challenge the narratives from my childhood? And I will argue that I found working for justice, wherever that takes me, actually gives me a sense of wholeness and a kind of spiritual peace, that contemplation and study call me to action. And I am aware that this is a very contentious issue, and so I just want to state up front that I speak to share, not to convince. I don't need to win this argument. But I do ask you to listen with an open mind and an open heart. So there are some basic questions. The first one, I think, is what stories do we tell ourselves? And what can we believe? And how can we understand the importance of framing all of this information that we have on this highly complicated topic? So a little bit of history. I did start out as a nice Jewish girl growing up in Sharon, Massachusetts. I went to Hebrew school 3 days a week. I had Orthodox immigrant grandparents in Brooklyn. We went there for all the holidays. I saved my quarters in the little blue and white tzedakah box to plant trees in Israel and make the desert bloom. I had a bat mitzvah. I had a very early obsession with the Holocaust, and my mother was a writer on Jewish topics, and she wrote a book called Voices from the Holocaust, so this was very present in our lives, even though we weren't survivors. And my family made a pilgrimage to Israel when I was 14, which I still remember as a very magical place. It was the land without a people, and we were the people without a land, so it worked out perfectly well. And I early on embraced the idea that my mission as a Jewish person was tikkun olam, to heal the world, which was pretty pretentious for a teenager. I also knew that we Jews were a distinct and endangered tribe living in a Christian America, that we were clearly an outsider group in a dominant culture. And I understood the real possibilities of anti-Semitism and annihilation. That was part of my cultural heritage. And to give you a flavor for that, as a teenager, when I started dating an African-American guy who was, you know, brilliant, played the violin with the Boston Symphony, went to Harvard, became a neurosurgeon, you know, he wasn't a slouch, my very liberal mother told me that if I married him, Hitler's dream would come true. And she threatened to sit Shiva and cast me out of the family. So I started in a very traditional place, but I was early on troubled with this sense of tribalism in my family and some vague feeling of hypocrisy that I couldn't put my fingers on. I'm also a child of the 60s, so I went to college and discovered the Vietnam War and politics and went to medical school and got involved with the women's movement and healthcare reform. So I became a much more political person. And then this got all thrown into the mix of my Jewish heritage and tribalism and past. So I had years of uncomfortable disconnect from my childhood beliefs. But with my increasing awareness of the Israeli occupation, that was fortified with a growing understanding of all the other political things I was learning about, like colonialism, racism, immigration, Islamophobia, you know, I became increasingly disenchanted with the version of Israeli history that I had learned in Hebrew school. So the good news is that one can only live with so much cognitive dissonance for so long. The bad news is that stepping outside of one's community and asking really difficult questions and talking with the, quote, enemy has major consequences. But the good news is that I was able to find and build a new, more diverse community or communities in which I can feel honest and whole. And I really recommend that as a place to live. So in the 1990s, with a group of similarly curious and agonized Jews, I began an active search for the stories that I had missed. And I got involved with a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group that then spread to lefty Israelis, other Arab peoples. And I discovered that there are numerous contradictions and problematic realities around Israel's founding mythology, the ongoing discrimination of Palestinians, and human rights violations. I also understand that this is exquisitely painful for the Jewish community to grapple with, and that there is tremendous pushback. But I really developed a hunger for more information. So in 1997, this group morphed into a series of grassroots organizations. And as I studied the history, I really finally realized I'd never actually met an Arab person. Yet I had grown up with what I now understand were pretty racist ideas about Arabs. But again, I felt compelled to collect the data. I'm a kind of little scientist type. So I was doing a lot of reading, listening to speakers, exploring way beyond the mainstream media, which you have to do if you're going to find anything out. And in 2003, with a group of other people who happened to all be physicians, including Ellen here, we started developing health and human rights delegations to Israel and Palestine. And so we would go, we would work with other clinicians, we would interview people, we'd go to refugee camps, we'd talk to Israelis, Palestinians, we went all over. And I actually have been in Gaza 3 times on this work. I also got involved with what was called Interfaith Peace Builders, which is now Eyewitness to Palestine, and went on an incredible delegation with African civil rights leaders who had worked with Martin Luther King. So traveling, for instance, to Hebron and having someone say, this looks like Mobile, Alabama in the 1950s was a very powerful eye-opening experience for me. And I traveled with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and also with Grassroots International. So I've had multiple trips documenting, interviewing, working. Now, I do this kind of work not out of a desire to destroy Israel, but because I came to understand that the supposed miracle of Israel born out of the ashes of the Holocaust, the, quote, light unto the nations, had, like many countries all over the world, committed and continues to commit serious injustices and human rights violations. And I feel that that is what seriously threatens the existence of the state. And because of the state of Israel speaks in my name, and I live in the country that provides the funding and the political cover for much of its behavior, the good and the bad, I, as a US citizen, make this all possible. So this became very personal responsibility. So I want to step back and say, well, let's look at what's the dominant paradigm. So the dominant paradigm is that Jews have been victimized by anti-Semitism in Europe for centuries. This culminated in the Holocaust. Israel was created as a refuge. A lot of people think, you know, God gave the Jews Israel. It's a thriving democracy. It's a haven for the oppressed, a center for culture, arts, universities, high tech, has gorgeous beaches, remarkable success story in a dangerous neighborhood. Besides, you know, Jewish people are inherently decent. We don't massacre or steal. We do not take what is not rightfully ours. We do not share our victimhood. This is the narrative of the victor. And this is a very painful mythology to give up. But as James Baldwin said about racism and discrimination in the US, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. So I found that it was critical to search out the narratives that we don't usually hear, the experience of dissenting Israeli Jews and Palestinians. And I found many painful paradoxes just crying out for examination. So I see increasingly belligerent occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, multiple hard-to-defend wars, and a growing awareness of what is called cross-sectional issues around racism, police brutality, militarism, and US foreign policy. And this really forced me to re-examine much of what my family held dear. And as an increasingly secular person, I also began to scrutinize the meaning of my own Jewishness and the uncomfortable consequences of Zionism and Jewish privilege. Now, I'm a part of a growing movement of Jews and allies in the US examining these hard things. This is my beloved community. And, you know, there are lots of groups, Peace Now, J Street, Jewish Voice of Peace, a variety of campus groups. There's a broad political spectrum here. But we're all concerned with the ongoing conflict in Israel-Palestine and our responsibilities as Jews and as US citizens to the State of Israel and to Palestinians. Now, I would argue that the self-definition of Jews as perpetual victims and chosen people has become an intensely toxic combination. There was this amazing skit by an Israeli comedian, Asaf Harel, last year. It was actually played on Israeli TV. And he was saying, you know, if you look at Israel, life is pretty good. You know, the healthcare could be better, and our politicians are a bit nuts. And, you know, but basically, it's really great. And then he went on to say, but there are a couple of million people that we're responsible for. And they're in a horrible state. Infrastructure, food, healthcare, education. Millions who are living in abject poverty. Gaza is on the verge of plague, hours on end without electricity or water. Israel controls everything that goes in or out. And then he made this incredible statement. Israel's most impressive innovation, more than any high-tech project or weapon, is our amazing ability to ignore what is happening mere kilometers away to our neighbors, a whole people, transparent, like it doesn't exist, not in the news, not online, not on social media, and definitely not in the hearts of the people. Nothing. So I see my responsibility as documenting the realities that we don't see and bringing these stories home. So, you know, I've written 3 books. I have a documentary film, which is an oral history. And I have, you know, have blogs and analysis and that kind of stuff. And so I see that as my work. And I find that speaking out is really less uncomfortable than being silent, which is being complicit. And I'm now working on a book for children, a middle grade book, and a young adult graphic novel, because I'm looking, you know, I'm looking for a publisher, first of all, if anyone's a publisher. But I'm also constantly exploring how we, at all levels of society, can have an honest, civil conversation about these very difficult but important issues that are really clouded by our own inability to see the full picture, to see the other. So what are the big take-home points that I learned? Well, first of all, I would argue that the current occupation is actually a continuation of more than 70 years of the colonization of Palestine, of treating Jews as more deserving, more human than Palestinians, and of Palestinians periodically, like many indigenous people, fighting back. This is my new framing. And I think it's important that Moshe Dayan, way back, the big general, he said he would have fought back if he had been an Arab, and that there's not a single place in this country that did not have an Arab population. Now, Palestinians have often had a dysfunctional, ineffective, and corrupt leadership, and this has only contributed to the catastrophe. But this has never been a battle between equal parties. So nothing is really new. It's only worse and more complicated. And the Israeli historian Ilan Pape said that he sees these constant themes of dehumanization and elimination of an indigenous people. So we need to learn and understand about the expulsion and dispossession and war against the indigenous Palestinians that started long before 1948, and since then has been disguised in the language of Jewish victimization and privilege, an endless stillborn peace process, which is basically all process and no peace, and the racist demonization of Palestinians as all being terrorists. We need to explore the impact of Jewish exceptionalism. And thus, I see 2 main challenges for the American and Israeli Jewish communities. The first one is the recognition of the Nakba, which is the Arabic word for catastrophe, for what happened in 1948. That's the expulsion of some 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction for over 600 villages and small towns. And a minister once said to me, and I quote, "Our collective denial creates a moral wound for all of us." Now, in the United States, this history is not part of the dominant paradigm. I mean, we Jews, we're the good people, we're the peace seekers, and those Arab Muslim people, they're the bad people, they're violent. And in Israel, Nakba history is not taught in the schools. And even commemoration of the Nakba is now a civil offense. So I want you to think about you learning US history and having no Native Americans, no slavery, no Japanese internment. What would we understand about America? And if people in Israel, whether they're Jews or Palestinians, start bringing up these ideas, they are attacked by right-wing thugs in the street, they are attacked in the Knesset. This is not a popular topic in Israel. So why is this so difficult? And I think it's a blend of ethical questions, morality, psychology, shame, trauma, entitlement. It's got a lot of aspects to it. We have the Jewish self-image that we're the good people, we're the victims of anti-Semitism, of the Holocaust. We deserve a country. And our victimhood gives us permission to do whatever is necessary to feel secure. So security is the holy word. Now, given that, it is extremely painful to acknowledge, particularly after the Holocaust, that one of the consequences of founding the State of Israel was the destruction of an indigenous people who had actually lived there for centuries. And there were Jews, Muslims, and Christians, who were actually not interested in being colonized or losing their land. So this conflict is not about Arabs fighting against Jews. It's about Arabs, and some of the Jews then called themselves Arabs, challenging Zionism, which is a political national movement that privileges Jews over everyone else. So this not only challenges our cultural self-image, but acknowledgement of the Nakba also entails apology, recompense, reparations. This is all very painful, difficult stuff. Now, I think the second big challenge for my community is around the issue of Zionism. Now, there are a lot of different kinds of Zionism, and if you know the history, it's complicated. But what are the consequences of political Zionism as it is now practiced? So we have a country that's founded on the basis of establishing an Arab free state, that was the original plan, where Jews can be safe. I mean, Jews should be able to be safe. Where Jewish trauma, aspirations, and history are privileged at the expense of everyone else. Now, there are several common arguments with that. First, there are the people that say, well, that's just not true. And I would suggest you go read your historians and the Israeli historians who've looked into the archives, because it actually is true. And then there are the people who say, well, it actually is true, but you know, we had to do it. That's what's necessary. Our victimization gives us permission to do it. So I would ask, well, what is the price of that? What is Jewish about the values of the current Jewish state? Now, my understanding of Israel is very different than where I started, obviously, because I not only appreciate the tremendous accomplishments of the state, and there are tremendous accomplishments, but I'm also concerned about the deeply corruptive realities, the ongoing occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the siege of Gaza, the second-class citizenship of Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship, and the long-standing unresolved issues of Palestinian refugees. I'm concerned about the rising levels of racism and demonization towards Palestinians within Israel. And I have a much deeper understanding of Zionism as a political movement, of the realities for Palestinians of the war in 1948, and the consequences of establishing a state where Jews are privileged over everyone else, and where there has been a steady expansion of borders and an increasing militarization of Israeli society. I worry about the cost of all of this to Jewish Israelis who are increasingly turning to the right, are increasingly racist and militaristic, and the price for Jews in the diaspora as well as for Palestinians worldwide. So for me, the problem is that no amount of incredible Israeli dance, theater, music, computer technology, gorgeous desert hikes, or spiritual moments can erase the facts of occupation, siege, and institutional discrimination. And these facts are deeply corruptive to Israeli Jewish society and to Jews in the diaspora. So the problem is that being a Jew and being a Zionist and supporting Israel right or wrong have all merged to the point where Israel is the religion. But Israel's not a religion, it's a country. So what's happening for us Jews and our allies is that we are all engaged in a rather loud, discursive battle, a lot of yelling probably, and a real struggle over the meaning and understanding of history and how to move forward. We are struggling to separate Judaism, the religion, from Zionism, the national political movement. And I frequently have young people come up to me and say, you know, Zionism has hijacked my Judaism. There is a call to define a Jew as someone who's grounded in religion or culture or history, a set of ethics, a sense of peoplehood. There's a lot of ways to be a Jew. And all the definitions need to be equally compelling. And so diaspora Jews are reclaiming our legitimacy as Jews and our right to be critical of the country that speaks in our name. We are trying to delineate the racist ideology of anti-Semitism, which exists in the world and has to be fought, you know, hating Jews or organizations solely because they're Jewish, from thoughtful, moral criticism of the policies of the state of Israel. We have an increasing understanding that Zionism inherently requires harm to Palestinians, that Zionism is a project of Jewish self-ghettoization, and that it has really failed to deliver a safer place for Jews. And what's happening is that the treatment of and solidarity with Palestinians has now become the civil rights issue of the day for many modern Jews, especially younger Jews who will be here long after the older post-Holocaust generation has moved on and no longer shapes the boundaries of intelligent conversation and discourse and the definitions of normalcy. So mostly what I see is that diaspora Jews are starting to own the Nakba as part of our story, to demand that Israel take responsibility for its contribution in the ongoing tragedy, and to work for universal human rights for all as the basis of moving forward. So Israeli exceptionalism has to be challenged. Israeli exceptionalism is basically an obstacle to honest conversation regarding human, civil, and political rights in the Middle East, and really impedes a forward-thinking quest for improving human rights and ending colonial enterprises as we're moving into the 21st century. And I believe that political Zionism is actually a violation of our religious and secular and cultural principles, and that after centuries of powerlessness, how we as a community handle our new position of power and privilege, which we now have, this is critical to our survival and to the survival of an ethical Jewish tradition, as well as a just resolution to more than a century-old struggle in historic Palestine that's being fought in our name. So at the same time, there is an increasingly open discussion, especially among younger people, of converting what was once a Palestinian national liberation struggle into a civil rights and human rights struggle within the Israeli state. And I would suggest that this would be good for Palestinians as well as their Jewish neighbors. We can all learn from that model. So in conclusion, I would say that I do understand the Jewish need for safety, but that need can only be sustained if it's built on an alliance with global forces that support human and civil rights for all and are united in the struggles against racism, police brutality, colonialism, ecological disasters, and the growing militarism and intolerance that is endangering this entire beloved planet. Thank you.